Boris Berezovsky, the man behind the documentary that Lauren Sheets just reported on, is a complex and intriguing figure, a mathematician turned auto dealer turned industrialist, media baron, power broker. In short, to use a word that he resents, oligarch.
I completely disagree with your definition of oligarch, that we in Russia who are rich are oligarch, and you here in the United States who are rich are not oligarchs. It's completely wrong, and I tried just to say that, yes, today in Russia we are not equal like in Soviet time. We have rich people, we have unfortunately a lot of poor people, but those people who become rich, they share a responsibility for building of new country.
That was Boris Berezovsky speaking in the U.S. 2 years ago. Whether he likes the label or not, Mr. Berezovsky is one of the six men profiled by David Hoffman in his new book, The Oligarchs, Wealth and Power in the New Russia. David Hoffman, how did Berezovsky go from studying applied mathematics to becoming rich and powerful?
Well, when Berezovsky was in his mathematics institute, he had a laboratory, which was just really a small room with a bunch of scientists. And Berezovsky loved the science, but he was really the organizer. Everyone says he was a compressed ball of energy running around town. If you needed a windshield wiper or a car for half a day, he was the hustler. He was the guy that always got everything together. So his little laboratory had a contract with the big, big Avtovaz auto factory in Russia, producing huge numbers of cars for a country that didn't have enough cars. And Berezovsky went down there and began to realize there was an enormous demand for cars and for spare parts and for everything to do with the auto factory. He also realized the assembly line of this factory was filled with thieves, small-time, petty thieves. They stood on the assembly line, and they took every eighth car, and they slapped a sticker on there and said, "That's mine, that's mine." Berezovsky never thought small. He went to the head of the auto factory. He said, "Look, I'll take 35,000 cars in one big contract. I'll give you 10% down and the rest in 2 years." And you know what happened? When it came time to pay them back, Berezovsky paid them back. But guess what? The ruble had crashed. He made $105 million. He knew that the ruble was going to crash. They didn't. He paid them back, but he paid them back in worthless money. He got the cars. He made his first fortune.
Well, did the car company manage to get rid of 300 small crooks and have to deal with one very big crook, or were they dealing with one creative, smart businessman?
Well, you know, I had an editor who asked me this question once. He said, "David, you know, these oligarchs, I don't understand. Are they criminals or are they capitalists?" And I have to tell you that they're not just simple thieves. If you look at the story of how these guys made their money, it would have been simple just to steal and to walk away. These guys came back. They finagled. They hustled. They actually got in their minds to try and take over the state, to buy the Kremlin. That's more than just simple thievery.
Berezovsky viewed himself, as you describe him, as the chairman of the board of a relatively small panel of rich individuals and some powerful people inside the Kremlin who should run Russia. That was it. That was his image for the country.
Not only his image, his guiding philosophy, his passion was Bolshoi Kapital, this big capital, should dictate to the people who are running the country what to do. And he wanted to tell them they should listen to him. He and his pals, the other oligarchs, they were the smart ones. They wanted to be listened to.
You write at one point in the book, Boris Berezovsky did more than anyone else to set the stage for Vladimir Putin to become the leader of Russia after Yeltsin. How did he do that?
He was despairing at the end of Yeltsin's term in 1999. They had no successor. Yeltsin had not paved the way for any logical successor. They were casting about, and Lushkov, the mayor of Moscow, and Yevgeny Primakov were coming on very strong.
Primakov was the prime minister.
Was the prime minister, and they were coming on very strong, and Berezovsky was very worried about this, and one of the first things he did was he sponsored essentially a smear campaign against Lushkov to destroy the single one real politician who was coming on to be Yeltsin's successor. And the next thing is that I think that the oligarchs themselves began to cast about who could succeed Yeltsin, and they picked the very unknown head of the FSB, the successor to the KGB, to be prime minister. And right as they did that, this new war broke out in Chechnya. And Mr. Putin was then the head of the FSB. He became prime minister. The war broke out. His ratings soared, and Berezovsky backed him.
And today, the relations between Vladimir Putin and Boris Berezovsky?
the relations are bad. You know, Berezovsky bailed out on Putin, and Putin bailed out on him. They had a couple of arguments, and the big one finally happened when the Kursk submarine sank. And Berezovsky's television station showed the bereaved widows. He broke, you know, secrecy, and Putin was on holiday, and Putin was on television, and it looked silly. He was on a jet ski.
On a jet ski, yes.
Yeah, and so Putin came to him and said, how can you do this? And Berezovsky said, look, open disclosure. It's good for you that I do this. And Putin said, I'm taking your television station away from you. And Berezovsky wrote him an angry letter and left the country for good.
I was surprised when I met Berezovsky, actually, having been prepared for someone a lot more evil in the way he presented himself, to meet this energetic, rather clever, and not seemingly very evil individual, unprepossessing.
Yeah, but you have to understand that he and the others came into this thing at a time when Russia was in a free fall. You know, we talk about corruption. We're a rule of law state. You know what the traffic laws are. This was a time when there was essentially complete vacuum. You know, I had a friend said leaving the Soviet system was like getting out of jail. And we had been in this dark, cramped place. And we went outside and suddenly sunshine, fresh air. Our knees were wobbly. And Berezovsky was among those. When they ran out into that fresh air, there were no rules.
When people like Boris Berezovsky were able to buy shares to control what had been state enterprises in Russia, as you write, the rules were set up in such a way to guarantee them the easiest competition. That is, you wouldn't have Pepsi-Cola come in and bid on the biscuit company in Moscow. Only Russians and a rather small group of people could possibly bid for things, which they consequently walked away with for a song.
This is absolutely correct. And if, as you know, some of the biggest pieces of this property, the best pieces, were in the second wave, the period we call loans for shares, which was going to be for cash. And a lot of this was natural resources. There was a lot of oil involved here, oil that today is extremely valuable to the people that want it. And they rigged these auctions so they would win.
There are selling prices for some of these state assets that you mention in the book that are just, they're staggering what people were getting away with. I mean, huge companies for a couple of $1 million people were spending.
Remember, the Soviet Union collapsed. It wasn't an orderly process. So what you were buying may have had huge debts, it may have had a lot of stealing, and it had a lot of oil in the ground. And so it was a real gamble. People used to say that the cheapest place in the world to drill for oil was on the Russian stock market.
Did you have the feeling when you were working in Moscow a few years ago that somehow you'd been transported to 1890s America and robber barons who arrived all over the country, or was this something uniquely Russian you were witnessing?
No, it was. Certainly it was uniquely Russian, but, you know, the Russians adopted and copied and loved the lore. Many of them had read Dreiser. They had read The Financier. And if you read the legends of the American robber barons, you see that it was being copied right before our eyes as the Russians remade their country. I'd like to add one thing, though. J.P. Morgan, particularly, was a bridge between the people who needed capital, the people building railroads in America, and the British who had the capital. But in the case of the Russian oligarchs, the real source of their capital wasn't some distance. It was the state itself. They were milking the government, the state, all the time.
David Hoffman, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
David Hoffman is the author of The Oligarchs, Wealth and Power in the New Russia. He's also the foreign editor of The Washington Post.